I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Diana Taylor. She's a filmmaker. She's director of photography for the HBO television series Weight of the Nation. And one of the films in the series, Weight of the Nation, is going to be screened this Thursday, the 30th of August, at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Welcome, Diana, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Great to be back.
And Krista Coggins is here. She's Vice President for Community Philanthropy at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which is presenting this screening. Great to have you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So this film, Weight of the Nation, or series of films, was actually a pretty gutsy thing for HBO to take on, wasn't it?
It was. HBO has got into a wonderful thing in terms of community service, which was to try to produce a series of public issue programs. One, the first one they did was really on addiction. Second one was on Alzheimer's, and now Weight of the Nation.
And is on obesity.
And therefore on obesity, yeah. And on our health generally, because it goes beyond obesity, essentially. It goes beyond what we're actually eating and how sick it's making us, even if we don't become obese. So it became a major public service commitment for them to do these programs, and they make them available on their website, which we can talk about at the end, but also with educational materials, the free streaming, free packets for communities who want to show the programs, which is how I imagine the Community Foundation discovered them.
Now, 68% of the people, according to this film, 68% of people in the United States are overweight or obese, and some of them morbidly obese. And this number has been rising precipitously since the early 1980s.
Exactly.
What happened in the early 1980s?
In the 1980s, the Centers for Disease Control realized that there was sort of a collusion of both policy, food consumption, and I think sort of diet-related things that converged at the same time. And when before that, people were dying from influenza, pneumonia, occasionally heart issues from smoking, they suddenly realized that 5 out of 10 deaths were related to people being overweight. And obesity is related to, you know, heart disease, fatty liver disease, cancer, diabetes, joint issues, skeletal muscle issues. It's a very complicated.
Dementia. Cancer, high blood pressure, stroke. Yeah. I mean, there's almost nothing that, of the major diseases that kill people, that isn't aggravated by obesity.
Exactly.
Now, you got involved in this film as director of photography, and you went all over the country.
Right. Well, so we spent, in terms of the production period, the actual shooting period of this project, in which culminated in 4 long-form films, we traveled for about 18 months to at least 40 cities, visiting medical centers, families, you know, alternative methods of farming, small family farms in the Midwest, all kinds of ways of finding examples of how good things are happening in terms of turning this around, but also really what the issues are. And they're still outstanding issues.
And you went to a place called Bogalusa, Louisiana, which figures prominently in one of the films in these series. Yeah. And this is a place where, what was it, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, they started doing a heart study there.
A marvelous doctor who's now in his 80s started the Bogalusa Heart Study. This is in Louisiana, where, you know, food is historically pretty rich and delicious, but pretty rich. And he began to study young children and has followed them all the way through into their 50s and 60s and began to see, and he studied kids not only of low poverty level children or low income levels, but he also studied kids who were middle class. And what he discovered was that diet was completely related to this, and he was able to follow exactly in their health what was happening to them. And when we were there filming them, we were filming new kids coming into the study. They were junior high schoolers. We were seeing children who were, at this point, not necessarily obese, but with high blood pressure. High blood pressure.
Kids with high blood pressure. One of the things
scary
that's striking, I mean, I stayed up half the night last night watching these films because they're there online. You can stream them. Mm-hmm. And each one of them is so fascinating. But one of the things that's really amazing is that a lot of these doctors in the films are saying, we've never seen these conditions in children before.
Right, exactly.
There was a pediatrician saying, we didn't study high blood pressure because that's not a pediatric issue, and now it is.
and we didn't study adult onset diabetes is now diabetes for children. It's not adult onset anymore. They've taken that out. They actually, diabetes, children are developing diabetes at a very young age. And children are certainly at risk with mothers who already have diabetes, women who are already pregnant, if they have diabetes, are putting their children and their own health at great risk.
And so that's not even a genetic thing. That's an environmental thing.
If a
pregnant mother has diabetes, her child is more likely to get it.
And diabetes, of course, is a direct relationship with obesity and eating too much sugar, of course.
So what are these people's diets like? I guess the children learn their eating habits from their parents. We can talk about school lunches in a second because that's its whole own subject. But what are they eating in Bogalusa and these
in
places?
In Bogalusa, sadly, they're not eating anything fresh at all. And they're eating packaged foods. Even the well-off children were eating packaged foods, drinking a ton of soda, eating very high-fat foods, burgers, deep-fried foods, and so forth. I mean, I know that other parts of the country don't necessarily share that diet, but what we do share is a high consumption of sugar, soda, a high consumption of fast food, cheap food.
Fast food and cheap food, and then that leads to, I mean, it's a very complicated subject because on the one hand, obesity is affecting people of every race, class, and income level.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, there is a strong correlation between poverty and obesity, and which doesn't seem, it seems completely counterintuitive. It seems like if you're poor, you might not have as much money to buy food, but it does. That's not how it works. What's going on?
Well, what we found in the urban centers is that there's a dearth of fresh foods and vegetables getting out to the people in urban centers, and certainly in the poorer urban centers. There's a dearth of good supermarkets, and there's no access to fruits and vegetables. So the classic corner store or bodega is selling basically fast packaged foods, which by the time they reach foods like that reach the shelf, they have absolutely no nutritional value and are only caloric. All they're doing is giving you calories. They're not giving you anything decent to eat.
Right.
So that's number one. We did a very interesting thing. In New York, we followed a new program called the Green Cart Program, where they are allowing an individual from a community to lease a green cart.
What's a green cart?
A green cart is a cart that goes out into the community. Every morning they go to the Hunter's Point distribution center. They load up with fruits and vegetables, and they have a small subsidy from the city, and they go into their community, and they sell on the corner fruits and vegetables, which sell out, like, as fast as you can say, 1, 2, 3. And that's been a real change, so that people were suddenly, and people who actually are low-income or immigrant families actually know how to prepare foods that are fresh, but they don't have access to them. So this was, you know, a pretty exciting program. It's sort of helping the sort of, quote, food desert problem. That's one issue. Trying to get good supermarkets that carry fruits and vegetables into these areas is also something that they're trying to achieve in the New York area, in the greater New York area.
Another thing is that we had a wonderful pair of filmmakers on recently who did a film called Food Stamped, and they were talking about how hard it is to eat a balanced diet and a healthy diet on the amount of money that you get when you get food stamps. And basically, they had to work really, they tried it for a week, and they had to work really, really hard to do it. And they were able to do it, but they couldn't get enough calories.
Right. That's really interesting.
And so basically, these high-calorie foods are keeping people alive on the very low budgets that they have, but without nutrition.
Without nutrition. And what happens in the brain is that the body continues to crave the nutrition that it's not getting. It's getting caloric intake. It's getting, you can burn on it for a while. But the nutritive value isn't there, and the body is just craving. And therefore, you eat more, and you eat more, and you eat more of these same low foods.
Another issue that came up in the film is that more affluent areas have parks and less affluent areas do not have parks. And kids are playing in parking lots. And they're just not getting the exercise.
Yeah, and of course we now have a screen society. And that's the other thing that happened since 1980 is that, you know, and certainly since 1960, there's an enormous percentage of people who are now driving to work. More people are driving to work. Fewer people are biking to work. Fewer people are walking to work. Kids aren't walking to school anymore. Kids are spending more time in front of screens. So you have the lack of exercise, which is always important for a human body. I mean, exercise is just one of the things that we were designed to have and keep us healthy, and we're not doing enough of it. It's just one of the basic tenets of being alive is to use the body. It's a great thing to have.
It is indeed.
And we're not doing that.
And so when you say screen society, you mean we're watching TV, computers,
cell phones. 7.3 hours or something of screen time a day, media time a day.
For
kids.
Kids are spending 7.3
hours
in front of screens.
Some kind of screen. That was the figure that we came up with. It's in the film. Yeah.
You know, I have to say, there's a lot of things that make me feel ancient, but, I mean, I grew up, at a certain point, we didn't have a television, but then we got a television. I grew up watching stupid sitcoms and all that kind of stuff, but certainly was not an extraordinary athlete or anything. I just did what the other kids did, which was play outdoors and watch TV and do my homework and eat Pop-Tarts and things like that. But that lifestyle of the, I guess, late 60s, 70s, and 80s seems really healthy compared to what we've got now for young people.
Yeah. I think because of this huge preponderance of overweight children, a third of our children are overweight. When I went into all these schools, I went into many, many schools, looking at the dearth of PE, the fact that PE isn't available anymore.
Physical education.
The fact that school lunch, that many of these kids get both their breakfast and their lunch at school, and that these foods are filled with sugar and fat and have absolutely no sort of nutritive value again. And looking at the children around me, and many of them were overweight, sadly overweight. And we've also, as a society, we've adjusted to looking at people around us who wear an extra 20 or 30 pounds, which is still a frightening number to be overweight by. And we go, oh, they're just a little round. I mean, our entire aesthetic has changed from someone who's a society of very slender people. We just accept this extra weight on children and on adults. We don't even think about it anymore. And it's sort of appalling that the entire aesthetic has changed.
We're talking to Diana Taylor about the film series Weight of the Nation. Now, one of the things that's interesting that comes out in the film is, I mean, we have an ongoing, raging health insurance debate, and many countries have either single-payer systems or systems where you don't have to go through your employer to get your health insurance. In the United States, if you have any health insurance at all, it's mostly through your employers. And there's an interesting example in the film of an employer who is looking at its employees and saying, oh boy, we've got some problems here, and we're going to institute a wellness program.
Right. So this has become an early movement in the United States, wellness programs that companies institute themselves as opposed to relying on the individual to do it or to get to a gym after a hard day of work. And this company was in Little Rock, Arkansas. They're a construction company with 1,000 employees. They build some of the biggest structures in and around Arkansas, and certainly in Little Rock. They're called Nabholz. So they began to see that their workers were becoming almost incompetent on the job, that the men could not lift, they couldn't climb ladders, they couldn't walk a great distance carrying weight, that their productivity was going way down. Now, this is not a unique situation in the United States. We are losing incredible productivity from our workers and from the companies therefore are losing a huge amount. So they instituted a wellness program. They brought in a woman named Jamie Mayo, who was just phenomenal in making these guys feel really comfortable around her. And she began to test their blood and put them through pretty comprehensive health testing and found almost over half of them were incredibly ill. Found things that none of them had knew about themselves in terms of early onset diabetes or health conditions, heart conditions, high cholesterols, hypertension, you name it, and skeletal structural issues with their bodies, huge arthritis issues because they were carrying too much weight. And they have, it's been in progress, I think, 3 or 4 years now, and they're just now finally seeing a turnaround in terms of their health costs. And they have a much healthier workforce. So that was really, for me to be there and see these men, you know, these hardworking construction guys really paying attention to their health because of an incentive program like this wellness program that Nabholz put into place, and beginning to turn around and understand what was happening to them, and also understand that what they were doing was rushing off to fast food. They wouldn't eat breakfast, then they'd work, then they'd rush to they'd jump in their trucks, go to a fast food for lunch, cram the stuff down, come back, bring some Cokes along, keep them awake at lunch, after lunch, you know. and that they were killing themselves. And they began to see that. And hopefully, you know, this begins a movement to change that kind of behavior, which was not winning for anyone.
Are these wellness programs catching on? Do you have any sense of that, or are various companies trying to do that? I mean, it certainly seems to be good for their, both for their health insurance costs and just for having a healthy workforce. You'd think everybody would be doing it.
Well, we found that this was one of the best examples. This was a company that was really willing to show how bad it had become and what they were trying to do. But the fact is that, yes, it is becoming a movement, but it takes some real commitment, both on the part of the workers, certainly, and then on the part of the company itself to institute these things. And they made a gym available for their workers. They made all the health testing available. Jamie Mayo is there to she'll talk to any worker anytime about his health issues or what's going on with him, keep him in his own loop about his health. And these guys, you know, they don't have time to think about that. But it's become part of the work life to have that.
What you just said, they don't have time to think about that. I was thinking about obesity and health problems in general in the context of a society which requires more and more productivity from people and pays them less and less. And there has to be a limit to that. I mean, if you just keep on following the graph of more productivity, less pay, people having to get extra jobs, at a certain point you reach this part on the graph where nobody gets sleep
anything.
And nobody gets paid.
Right. And of course we looked at the level of stress that people are under. We went to San Francisco and met with a doctor named Dr. Alyssa Eppel, who's doing huge studies on what stress does to the brain. And the brain essentially needs fats, it needs sugar, and it needs salt. That's hardwired into us. Early mutations from thousands and thousands of years ago. We need those basic things to function. Because we're hardwired to need those things, we now are in a situation where those things are so easy to come by that we can't resist them. Because literally it's an addiction. And she's been looking at what happens in the brain when stress is up. And stress is there for all of us. I mean, we're all enormously stressed. So cortisol is released and adrenaline is released. And both of those are like a sort of a toxic soup for the brain. And it says, I need salt, I need oil, I need sugar. Those foods that have those things are like opiates for the brain, and they calm the brain down. So the first thing we desire, it's a highly addictive process. And we have to forgive ourselves that this is what happens. This is how we're built. We were built this way for thousands and thousands of years, but because of the excess of food around us and the food that's available to us and the food that's available cheaply for us and what's readily accessible when you walk outside and there are 10 fast food restaurants near you, that's where you'll go to sort of relieve stress quickly.
And those things are hardwired into us in an evolutionary context where there's not a whole lot of fat, salt, and sugar around. I mean, back in the the jungles and savannas and stuff, right, where early humans mm-hmm. roamed around, it was an amazing thing to kill a mammal and eat it. It was not an everyday occurrence.
Right. And we focus on that. We focus on we called it the mismatch. It's this notion of how we're built as human beings, how our bodies work, and where we are now in society, and that those things are don't work together. We looked at the fact that, yes, you know, we would have huge physical activity in order to find food, create food, have a kill. At that point, we would all eat as much as possible. The brain is wired. This is a very interesting fact. The brain only gets the signal to stop eating at the very bottom, at the top of the colon, basically. And that's because we had to eat as much as possible. If the brain had a signal to, after four bites, turn off, we wouldn't have eaten enough in those times where there was famine or shortage of food. So that signal is way down below. But of course, now that we have so much food, we eat and we eat and we eat. We don't get that signal right away. In fact, some people now they're finding are not even born with that signal. It's a very difficult conundrum for those that don't have that signal.
Oh,
it's a hormonal.
Goodness.
It's a hormonal signal, and it's a hormone called leptin. But at any rate, we were designed. That's where the signal gets, the enzyme gets, comes out. The signal's made way down low, and so we've eaten quite a bit. This is why they say, you know, stop after 15 minutes and wait and see if you feel full.
And it's true.
And
if you stop eating after a while and you just go do something else and you come back to
you
your...
You go, oh, I'm not that... Yeah, I'm not hungry anymore. But if you keep eating because because the opiates are at work, right? These opiates that are helping us feel a little more comforted, a little happier, a little soothed, more soothed in our stressed lives. And, you know, when we look at this, this is where we can begin to forgive ourselves and people who are struggling with weight, because although it is a deep personal commitment to lose weight and change one's lifestyle, these things are very hardwired in us. It's very, very difficult to overcome them. And the diet food, the diet industry, the diet book industry, for instance, it's a really interesting part of the film, too. You know, diet books, diets, right? They have no interest, really, in solving the problem, or they wouldn't make any money. And publishers certainly are not going to put out books that say, you know, just eat a little less and you'll be fine. So it always has to have, it's a book that has to attach a gimmick to it and sound like it's the new thing. And it's sort of a secret, mysterious thing that if you do this, you will definitely lose weight. The fact is, the only thing that will help you lose weight is calories in, calories out, and a lifestyle change where your body's getting real nutrition from real food, ideally local food, buy fresh, buy local foods.
Right. We're talking to Diana Taylor about the HBO film series Weight of the Nation. Now, one of the real ironies of our nation is that half of our farmland is devoted to corn and soy. These are subsidized crops. And what was it, less than 3% is devoted to growing fruits
and
vegetables
in this country. Yeah.
And so as a nation, we are actually unable to meet our own dietary guidelines that they put out to the kids in school. We don't grow enough fruits and vegetables for people to actually meet our fruits and vegetables guidelines.
And so we're relying on fruit coming in from Chile and from Mexico and from all these other places where we're going through this huge infrastructure of shipping things in, containerizing them, bringing them in. So by the time they get to you, they're also half-valued in terms of their nutrition, frankly, too.
Right.
But yes, we are. And in Iowa, for instance, which is some of the most fertile farmland forever, it's 0.04% of the farmland is devoted to fruits and vegetables. So we're really, we need to turn that around. But, if you look at the soda industry is highly profitable. You can 90% profit on selling soda, 10% profit on selling fruits and vegetables. That can change if the subsidies change. The farm bill just happened again. Not much changed. Unfortunately, it was in May. The farm bill was reissued in May. But, we're looking at a completely upside down.
Why are these things subsidized?
Pyramid.
What is it? Wheat, corn, and soy?
And sugar beets, yeah.
And sugar beets are all subsidized. Mm-hmm. And those are all the components of cheap, high calorie, nutrition free fast food.
Right.
Although.
And high fructose corn syrup.
And in theory.
And animal feed and all those other things. I mean, there was a point at which America needed, in the 60s, and 50s, America needed to. Saw a need to begin to feed all its people, and there became mega farming became huge and bigger and bigger and bigger, and there was some sense to all that. But what's happened is our nutrition has gone way down as a result.
And one of the problems also is that there are so many fewer family farms, and family farms had an easier time providing fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm. They do. There's some great scenes with small family farmers actually in the hour four that you'll be showing, which is the hour called Challenges. There are 4 hours to the series.
And, these farmers, I can't remember, where were they that you...
They were in Missouri.
That was in Missouri.
Missouri, Kansas City. Well, we did a number of small family farmers, but there's...
anywhere in the country.
It could have been anywhere in the country, and there's a great story. There's a woman named Diana Endicott who was a small family farmer, and she went to the farmer's market one day with all of her wares and had an abundance of tomatoes left over. She went to the local supermarket, which was a ball supermarket. I think it was called Price Chopper. There are 27 of them in the Kansas City, Missouri area there. And she went in and she said, I've got all these tomatoes. And the manager of the store took a bite of one and he said, wow, these are delicious. Sure, I'll put it up on my, put it in one of my things with, local tomatoes. They sold out in 2 hours, apparently. He said, you should come back, and if you have any more next week, come back. She came back with three farmers. They brought honey, they brought carrots, and extra tomatoes the next time. He sampled all of them. He quickly put them up, and they sold out like that.
Yeah.
So David Ball, who's the owner of 27 supermarkets in that area, came up with a program to support the local farmers. He helped them with distribution. He helped them with, keeping a refrigeration area and trucking so that he could bring local produce into his stores. Not all of it was organic, but it was literally 2 days off the farm. So people were at least buying locally fresh foods. And so what I learned from that for me was buying locally and fresh is almost as important as buying organic. That if I can get something that's 2 days old, I know I'm getting the full value of that, and any cravings I have for sugar and everything else is going to go way down because I'm actually getting the full nutritive value.
That's right.
Of those foods.
And as I meant to ask you before, that there are, I mean, going back to the piece about how we evolved, how our bodies mm-hmm. evolved, we didn't really have access to sugar except if
honey.
You had it, yeah, if you raided a honeybee hive.
Exactly right. If you raided a honeybee hive, that was... And the only other sugar we had was if you ran across a fruit tree that was producing at that season, at which point it was wonderful. You didn't then press it and make apple juice out of it, which
right.
is very high sugar, and you're not getting the pulp and everything else, which has all the minerals in it. What people were doing was eating that fruit, and the sugar in that fruit is what made it palatable to eat, the banana, and that got hardwired into the brain. Ah, apple. Good, need, you know,
yeah.
sugar, supports the body.
Right.
And so, but you didn't get those all the time. Now we have it, you know, 20 feet away from us most of the time.
And
not apples,
juice.
I mean candy bars or whatever else.
Yeah, or soda or fruit juice. And fruit juice is just
equally
as bad,
bad
as soda.
Is equally bad. We weren't designed to eat the sugar of seven oranges or the sugar of seven or eight apples in a swig. We just weren't. It's not, and that's the sad part. I was so depressed by this fact. I thought, oh, well, at least I can drink fruit juice. At least fruit juice is good for us. Well, it's good for us, but it absolutely hammers the insulin system of the body. It's taking us toward diabetes like a soda would, sadly.
Well, and there are so many things that one can do, and the film does go into the questions of diet, and there's, as you say, there's so many different ideas about how to lose weight and what people can do. But for example, something I've been doing for the last 10 years is putting 1 inch of juice at the bottom of a glass and filling the rest
water.
Up with water.
Perfect.
And then you're done.
Yeah.
It's easy.
Yeah. We did a great test with kids out at UCSF, actually, where there was a lineup of every drink that's available on the market, literally every, from water all the way through to Frappuccinos and all the sweet tea drinks and coffee drinks and everything that's on the market, and all the sodas, needless to say. And each container was filled with the white sugar equivalent of what was in that drink. And kids who came in had to sort of guess and see. This was for children who were now obese and struggling with how to begin to rein in their diets. Really wonderful program at UCSF. And it was stunning to see how much sugar is in each one of these drinks. Frappuccino was the worst.
Really?
Absolutely the worst. Yeah.
And that has...
And water was the only one that was really, really good. And I want to say one other thing. People say, oh, great, well, I'll have the alternative sugars. You know, I'll have Sweetina or whatever they are.
Oh, the, like...
Or aspartame or whatever the fake
the
sugars are.
The neurotoxin ones, yeah.
Those do not help us in terms of a lifestyle change, in terms of reducing the need for sweet. They keep that cycle going. And you're ingesting enormous number of chemicals, which again, wreak havoc in the body. So to say, well, I'll solve that by having artificial sweeteners, is not the way to go. The way to go is to very slowly wean yourself off sugar.
And is slowly a key?
Slowly is a key. Every doctor, no matter what health center, no matter where we were, said diets will not work. You will yo-yo around forever. You'll do sometimes harm to your body by doing these extreme things. Just eat a sensible diet, eliminate the sugar, eliminate the fat, small portions, and exercise. And if you do that over a period of time, remarkable things will happen. You will lose weight.
Eliminating beer seems to help for a lot of people, too.
Yeah. Alcohol in general, but yeah.
We're talking to Diana Taylor about the film Weight of the Nation. So... One thing that's interesting is our tastes get really affected by the availability of all these sweet foods
right.
and all these salty foods and fatty foods, and we develop a taste for chips and chocolate and
right.
things like that.
Right.
But then there's something that you said a moment ago which was really interesting, that when people actually have access to a fresh tomato that was picked the day before yesterday or fresh honey, they love those things. So the taste for healthy food seems to still be there deep within us.
It is deep within us. And I think I was so staggered by everything that I learned on this. I began to slowly wean myself into new habits myself. And it's hard work, but it's a commitment. Every day you say a little bit more to the left or right, whatever one you want it to be, toward health. Just a little bit, just a little bit, just a little bit. A little less sugar, a little less, one less soda, you know, not going to the fast food restaurant that day. But if you're eating healthy foods and you're eating a lot of them, they begin that taste becomes so enriched in you that when you go back and eat some junk, or at least something that is basically cardboard with a lot of salt and fat and sugar put into it, which is most of what packaged food is, you don't have a taste for it much anymore.
I know. A few years ago, I ate a Pop-Tart, and it just wasn't as good as it used to be.
I know. It's like those sugar donuts, which I used to love so much. Can't do that anymore. They just are grotesque. Yeah.
So in our country, we have a situation where tens of billions of dollars are spent, taxpayer subsidies, I must add, on subsidizing wheat, sugar, and soy, and corn, and things like that go into these unhealthy foods we eat. Fruits and vegetables aren't subsidized at all.
Right.
And those tens of billions of dollars then get multiplied into health care costs.
They do.
And so this, and it's ballooning. I mean, we're not even anywhere near where we could be in 10 years if we don't watch out. This could bring down the country.
Yeah, the deaths of diabetes. We won't have a military force that can serve because people in the military aren't eating good food. We have kids who are eating bad food from the beginning, you know, in schools. We have hospitals that aren't feeding us well. But the healthcare cost is frightening. And it's so short-sighted because if we're eating cheaply now, the healthcare costs will be greater later. So we're in this very difficult conundrum, whereas if we think we're saving money now, even in our family, even in our personal lives, if I think, oh, great, I'm going to eat another fast food meal, and I think that my healthcare in 10 years or 15 years is going to be cheaper, it's not. It's going to be twice or three times as much. So it's much wiser to start exercising now and eating good foods. And yes, people say, oh, well, Whole Foods is so expensive. You know, these foods are expensive. But there are ways in which you can work around. You don't have to buy the most expensive foods. You can buy fresh foods and live on them fine. You don't need to buy as much. You can. They did a comparison also in this film of meal preparation. And I think they combined 6 or 7 meals of preparation, how much they cost and what their health benefits were. And they were able to come up with meals that cost less than the fast food meal and were much, much healthier. It's not that hard to do. That's sort of a myth at this point. I mean, yes, it's easy if you go into Whole Foods to say, oh, this is so astronomically expensive. And people say, oh, well, farmers markets are too. But if you buy wisely at those places and really take the time to prepare those foods, and let's face it, the dining table in America has become the minivan drive-through. Families, exhausted parents, stressed parents, I understand all this. Oh, let's just feed everybody. I couldn't buy food today. I couldn't get to a market today. Let's drive through, buy fast food, and we eat it in the minivan. And that way of living is perpetuating a really, really, really... I mean, the stress is there. The lack of communication is there. Inactivity is there. And lack of fresh food is there.
And
that's just the recipe for disaster.
And people having multiple jobs.
Yeah, I know. I know.
It's like when you look at the big picture, a bunch of things have got to change in order for us to be healthy and less stressed again.
Mm-hmm. It's a countrywide issue. It's a multi-layered issue. It's not just the individual.
Right. It's not just the individual, although the individual has to take some responsibility.
Absolutely.
But if everybody were to demand fresh food in farmers markets, and if everybody were to demand proper wages, corporate America would take a big, big hit. And so they're fighting against it at every step of the way.
Right. As is the diet industry and everything else. I mean, it's one giant collusion toward keeping us sort of the way we are. But the country itself, America itself, if we look at it in terms of a world picture, is losing the game here because we have so many people who are unhealthy.
Although I have to say, as I was watching the movie, I started searching for obesity rates in other countries, and it's growing very fast in Europe. And I was wondering whether you could like make a correlation between the opening of American fast food chains in those countries and
their obesity
foods rates.
And the availability of packaged foods. Packaged foods, which again have no nutritive value, but satisfy the sort of addictive brain behavior. You know how it is. You're looking at those chips and they just look so good. You have one and it's like, I've got to have another. Oh, that's so good. That's salt. Got to have another. And that is an addictive behavior that we can't blame ourselves for. That's really how we're built. So in order to cope with that, we need to go back to more fresh options.
Now, there is a part in one of these films where they compare the fast food industry to the tobacco industry, or the unhealthy food industry to the tobacco industry, and say, look, smoking was ubiquitous 50 years ago, and there was this huge campaign.
Yeah.
Do you think such a campaign is happening, and can it be successful?
Well, this series is part of that campaign, and it's successful. It can be successful, except that we have to eat. Whereas with smoking, you don't have to smoke, but we have to eat to live. And so that's the conundrum there, except that we can eat more healthfully. And it doesn't take a huge change. It doesn't take a huge, huge change. But it does take a huge change in terms of the country infrastructure and how we're supported around this, that not at every corner is a fast food restaurant, but at every corner there's some fresh food that's available. And that we don't have to eat 24/7, that people can't resist packaging, colorful packaging. We looked at supermarkets and how they package and where they place their foods, how when you enter a market, what you see first, of course, appealing to the addicted brain, or the hardwired brain from thousands of years ago, that, you know, the whole system has to change to support that. Fruits and vegetables need to be the first thing you see when you walk into the supermarket, the first thing you see. Gorgeous, the colors, the varieties, the, you know, you can smell it, you know.
Well, who was it? Was it Michael Pollan who was saying, just buy the stuff that's around the edges
of the supermarket.
Supermarket.
Don't penetrate the middle.
And don't go into the center where the packaged stuff is.
Yeah, he does say that.
Now, another part of it, of the problem which you talk about in the film, is school lunches. They're very bad, but they were never good.
They were never great, but they were a little better than they are now, certainly. Because what's available now are these a la carte areas of these kids' schools where they can get, you know, we used to only have white regular milk available. Now it's strawberry milk, chocolate milk, and the kids go through. They don't touch the white milk. They go straight for the little carton of chocolate, little carton of chocolate, little carton of strawberry chocolate, you know. And these a la carte areas of the school lunches are filled with packaged, you know, anything packaged, cookies, chips, even if they say low-cal on them, they're still salty. The high schools have a string of we saw high schools that have mini fast food concessions with labels across the top, pizza, hamburgers, Frito pies. And you go up, and it's just exactly as if you're attending a fast food restaurant, and you pull out you get a pizza that's packaged in a cardboard box. This is and huge vending machines full of pop, full of soda, which they're trying to outlaw. And we have to remember that every time people say, we don't want the government to say we can't have soda, we don't want the government to say that we should eat more broccoli, we don't want the government to say we shouldn't have these foods, we have to remember now that we're being controlled by the corporate industries that are making these foods.
Right.
So we're already being controlled by a huge, in fact, government-supported industry that's telling us what to eat by what it's putting in front of us, which is different than giving us choice.
And if you think of the schools as part of our public government, public schools are part of what we pay our tax dollars for. If that branch of the government, the education system, is giving you Frito pie, then they're basically controlling what you eat.
They're absolutely, and the kids who come to school hungry and who eat breakfast are getting really, really bad breakfasts. I mean, they're getting, you know, a fake waffle I watched the production lines. We went to production lines where these foods are created. They're getting a bad frozen waffle that's made out of, you know, white flour that's been frozen, then been put on a grill and heated up with syrup, with a package of syrup. That's breakfast. How long is that going to last a kid before they have sugar shock?
Right.
You know.
And, of course, that affects their performance in school.
Yeah. We really have to begin to go back and look at the entire picture, and this series of films on HBO really helps us do that. And I urge people to go to the website. They've made it incredibly user friendly. The films are really compelling. They're films about children. We also did many supplemental films. So if there's a subject that is particularly pertinent to you and your life, you can go to one of the supplemental films that then supports that topic, and we open up the topic for another, you know, a 15-12 minute film on that topic. There's educational materials free available. There's DVDs available for you to share with your community. It's an incredibly user-friendly website, and I urge people to go there and watch the films.
And the website is theweightofthenation.hbo.com. Now, Krista Coggins, you are with the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which is presenting this film on Thursday night at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. How did you guys get involved in promoting this film?
The Santa Fe Community Foundation tries to really listen to issues that pertain to the entire community, and we work in a lot of different areas, including arts, education, environment, and of course health and human services is a very important focus of our work. So when this movie came to our attention, we like very much to take advantage of opportunities where we can create a presentation for the community. It's a free event, and this movie will be shown at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion at 7 o'clock on Thursday.
Tomorrow
night. Following the presentation of the movie, and as you've heard, this will just be part four of a four-part series, there will be some audience question and answer period with some panelists. We've got Dolores Roybal coming from Conalma Health Foundation, Pam Roy from Farm to Table, Greg Menke, who's a local caterer, and possibly Nota Begay from the Nota Begay Foundation to address local solutions to some of the food challenges.
What do you see here? See here in Santa Fe? Do we have as much of a problem as in the rest of the country?
We do. New Mexico actually ranks fourth in the nation in hunger, and as you've heard, hunger is also a function of poverty and obesity. They're all connected. We have several wonderful nonprofits working in Santa Fe to address hunger and obesity and healthy food choices. One is this a great nonprofit called Cooking with Kids, which actually brings healthy foods, locally grown foods, and just healthy foods in general, not necessarily locally grown, in the form of cooking classes into area Santa Fe public schools, elementary
They're
schools.
They're fabulous.
They are. And just last year, they reached almost 4,000 kids through 172 classrooms in 10 different Santa Fe public schools. Another wonderful program is the Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute, which works with local farmers. They create, they have a program for microloans to help farmers. They offer community cooking classes. They offer professional development workshops so farmers can learn business modeling and techniques to make their own work profitable. They, at the farmers market, as you may have heard, they accept SNAP coupons so people can use food stamps. SNAP is Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Plan. They can use those chits at the market to buy healthy local produce. And there's another program called MoGrow, which you may have heard about, Mary Charlotte. It's a mobile grocery that brings a truck, literally an 18-wheel truck that's been completely retrofitted to be a mobile grocery store. And they started out in Santo Domingo Pueblo. They're now getting ready to expand to a second Pueblo. But when you walk into this truck, it's like a miniature supermarket, but it just contains healthy, fresh, and frozen foods. So you literally walk in one door, do your shopping, there's a checkout at the end, and then you exit. And this has been wildly popular.
We filmed one of those, too. It's in one of the films. It's really an incredible program. And they can pull into any parking lot anywhere where, again, there's a dearth of fresh fruits and vegetables, and people come out. We were in a tenement area somewhere outside of St. Louis, and people flocked out of the buildings to buy food there. Food was reasonably priced and incredibly fresh, and it was in this retrofitted truck. It was really exciting, actually, to see.
Yeah. Did you see, when you were making the film, Diana, people, a movement of people growing their own food or
yes.
community gardens?
Yes, we did see all of that. But one of the biggest issues, again, even though we can all eat locally, was how do we get distribution centers for farmers? How do we get refrigeration units? And how do we get trucks in support of that? And small farmers cannot get the loans that the big farmers get. The big farmers get enormous loans. Small farmers are not loaned to. This is just part of the sort of the subsidy problem, essentially.
Yeah,
they cannot get loans, and so they cannot get loans to make a small refrigeration unit. And I'm taking us away from what Krista was saying,
which is why the microloan program
yeah,
at the Santa Fe
so
Farmers
great.
Market Institute is so important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's also this ridiculous discrimination against organic farmers. They have to fill out mountains of paperwork, whereas if you use pesticides, you're exempt from all paperwork.
Right.
Why it's not the opposite is a complete mystery to me, except for the obvious thought of the chemical industry lobbies, but you would think you would have to fill out paperwork to have people know what pesticides are on the food that they're about to eat.
That's right, but they're not forced to do that.
They're not forced to do that. How long were you on the road filming this series?
We were on the road about 18 months, almost 2 years, actually. We did almost 2 years, I would say.
And what were the most hopeful moments for you in terms of what you saw, what you filmed?
I think the revolutionary work of Dr. Lustig, who's working on sugar, who is really getting the word out about how sugar, what kind of a poison sugar really is, in all of its forms, not just in the white sugar form. That was really inspirational and very moving. The work that the small family farmers are doing are trying to organize about how they can come together. The Diana Endicott story, where she helped 250 small farmers coalesce around these 27 markets, 27 regular supermarkets supporting their efforts, those markets being full of fresh chicken eggs, fresh meat, all local, from 250 local farmers. And that was really exciting because it's so hard for these local farmers to get together. The work of America Bracho in Santa Ana, California, the highest density population of poverty, mostly Latin American families, high rate of diabetes, not one park in the whole area. She runs Latino Health Access, and her efforts to create a program called Promotores, which are people who go out into the communities from the community. They're in the community, they get educated as to how to, and they can talk to each other because they share the same language, they know the same, and they speak about similar issues and they help educate. And it's an incredibly exciting program. That was over the top beautiful to watch her and her program.
And they spent 7 years trying to get just a little park permitted. The city council is taking 7 years to give them permits.
Right, and it was you know, these wonderful Latino mothers who had no support whatsoever and who hardly spoke English, who steadfastly fought for this park, and who also then go into each other's homes. They get educated by Latino Health Asset. They go into each other's homes and help explain healthy diet or diabetes or all these things, so that it becomes, the mothers are really become the key to the health in the community.
The film is called The Weight of the Nation, and it's actually a series of films, and filmmaker and director of photography for the series, Diana Taylor, has joined us. Thank you so much for being with us. And Krista Coggins is the Vice President for Community Philanthropy for the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which is presenting this, one of the films in this series, tomorrow night, the 30th of August at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. The Santa Fe Community Foundation is on the web at santafecf.org. The website of the film is theweightofthenation.hbo.com. And once again, the event tomorrow night is a free event. Ladies, thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for what you do, Mary Charlotte. It's great.